sleep with others.
Thanks everyone for coming to the first day of Devo Week, Digital Week Week. And here's my real contact info. Please feel free to contact me anytime for any reason. I'm happy to help any way that I can, always. So just a little bit about me before getting into the rest of my talk. I am a geek. I'm an introverted geek. And I've done a lot of things that other people think are interesting. I think a lot of it's interesting too. I'm kind of most famous for being a developer of virtual reality in the mid to late 1980s. I helped a lot of small companies with their problems as a consultant, a contractor, freelance, through the 80s and 90s, and I saw all these companies make incredibly stupid mistakes, and I realized that I can make my own stupid mistakes. So I started my own company and made many of them. But it was a success. And I learned a lot from that too. Anyways, lots of long, stupid stories from Silly Valley in there, but I won't go over that today. I'm probably most famous for creating a keychain, TV Be Gone, that turns off televisions in public places. That is all it does. It's conceptually very easy. It just sends out off codes for every TV ever made, and the one in front of you will stop being annoying because it'll be off. So I made a TV Be Gone kit and TV Be Gone Pro, which turns off TVs, of course, at 100 meters away, because you never know. I'm also somewhat famous for creating an early hackerspace in the United States, the country I used to live in. I live in Berlin now. And NoiseBridge is, along with many of the hackerspaces that have been around, about 40 of them, mostly in Germany at the time, 2007. Together, we were examples for the rest of the world to start making hackerspaces. And there are a lot of them now, and it's really cool to visit them wherever you go. They're, if you ever need new geeky friends, just go to one of those dots. Kind of like here. So I go around the world when there's not a pandemic giving talks and workshops, and it's so great to be able to be surrounded by geeky people again, live and in person. I also give workshops all over the world. These are just a few random pictures that I put together. So, we can learn a lot from other people, and it's important to learn from other people. But I'm going to be sharing some of my experiences with you, and hopefully you'll learn something from my experiences. But if we're going to really cruise in our lives, quite often we have to go off and think for ourselves and do things in our own way, and perhaps in our community's way, small individual communities. And we can do so much more than just merely conventional. And sometimes we have to take risks doing that, and sometimes it's scary. And again, with community, sometimes that's much easier, and we can be supportive in doing that. But I love my life, and that's kind of weird because it wasn't easy. It was a long road to get from a total depressed blob of a kid to becoming a crazy-haired inventor who does love my life. And when there's not a pandemic, traveling all over and being sort of like jet-setting or something. But the only reason I was able to do that was I got support where I needed it at critical times. There was a lot of luck that's involved always, a lot of effort on my part, and a lot of choices that I learned from. A lot of stupid choices, a lot of good choices that didn't work, but learning from all those choices. Choices over, in particular in this talk, TV and media in my life, in our lives. Choices about work, how to get resources to live. Choices about community. And I've learned to love my job. So let's talk about job. I looked up online about how many people are unhappy with their work. And since the internet is where all the truth exists and all the lies, I looked at the internet. And of course, the internet is mostly about the country I left, but in that country, 80% of people claim to be unhappy with their work. That's a lot. And work is, at least a third of our lives. We work 8 hours a day. And then we sleep 8 hours a day, and we're probably going to dream about what we were doing when we were awake. And if we don't like our job, that means our dreams suck. That's two-thirds of our lives that suck. And then there's only 8 hours left. And if you're like the average American who watches 6.5 hours of screen time every day, when is there any time to do anything worthwhile or even explore what might be worthwhile? But I turn TVs off for a living, and I love my job. And by presenting my journey from that depressed blob of a kid to who I am now, I hope others can benefit from my experience. And if I can go through that journey in my way, everyone can in their way. And it's not necessarily easy, but it's way worthwhile and way rewarding. So I definitely did not start off loving my life. I was totally depressed as a kid. I grew up in my own little world, propelled there by being brutally bullied, targeted for being an introverted geek, for being gay, for being bad at sports, for being fat. And I was beaten up every day, often while the gym teacher watched. Hopefully, I don't know, are gym teachers as horrible here as they are where I grew up?
Hopefully not.
I hope not. So teachers clearly weren't any help. My parents were depressed as I was. They couldn't deal with their pain, let alone mine. My life was just hell. So when I got home, I escaped into the magical world of television. Kids on TV, unlike me, were beautiful, had loving parents, understanding friends, problems that resolved at the end of every half-hour show. Comparing myself to them, my life was horrible, and I became more depressed. I didn't do anything worthwhile. I would watch the next show and the next show. I would eat junk food, watching and getting fatter than I already was. I wasn't doing anything active. I wasn't learning how to deal with other kids. I withdrew more into myself, only to become more of a target at school, only to retreat into television again when I got home. I am a TV addict. But there are so many ways of avoiding oneself, and I've tried lots of them. And all of them have their pluses as well as their minuses. And I'll go over just a couple here. Geeking out is something I've always loved doing, but it's so solo. But electronic parts are super great. They always do what they're told to do. They do exactly what they're told to do all the time. And you can build such cool things with them. But I kept doing it even though all the other kids tormented me for it. And back then, this is the 60s, we didn't all have like gadgets in our pockets. Being a geek was like kind of dangerous in the United States. But anyways, I kept doing it. And then there's travel. My family, middle class America, 1960s, they did the middle class travel ritual, more like a torture ritual, really, which is stuffing the whole family into one of these station wagon things, picking a direction and calling it vacation. But there were cool aspects to it as well. And nobody died. Mostly it would have been from us inside the car, not the external. But and I learned to love to travel. But there are aspects of traveling that many people do, including myself, in order to try to escape from ourselves. But there's cool aspects as well. But anyways, I have to talk about pot here because it saved my life. It really did. In my high school in the 1970s, all you had to do to be considered cool was smoke pot. Suddenly, I actually liked hanging out with other kids, and it led to my first popular invention, which was an electronic bong. So, like everything else in my life at that point, I abused what worked. So, feeling trapped at work is another great way to avoid oneself. I learned this from my workaholic dad. I tried it at my first real job, living in a town that I hated. And I hated that job, but I lived in this beautiful rent-controlled apartment, but it just kept me staying at this job I didn't like, in a town that I didn't like, at a job I didn't like. Choice is a really powerful thing. I was an uptight, TV-watching closet case feeling trapped at work in a town I hated. Those were all of my choices, and I was miserable. So it was time for new choices. I never liked TV, even as a kid, watching it all the time. Watch TV 8 hours, sleep 8 hours. When is there time to do anything else? What else is there to do? If I don't watch TV, what would I do? Well, I quit. I had to start somewhere, so I stopped doing what I knew I didn't like. I stopped doing what I hated. And that also led me to quit my work. The work I knew I hated in a town I didn't like. So I bought a VW van after quitting my job. I moved away from that horrible town that I didn't like. And I started to travel. One thing with traveling is you get to choose whatever direction you like if you don't have a goal. And I didn't have a goal. My only goal was to get the hell out of that town I didn't like, which was Boston, by the way. And what makes me choose one direction or another? It's just like whichever way feels better. So I made a choice. And a choice leads to another choice, and another choice. And before I know it, I'm in Alaska. At my first consulting job at a fish cannery. Knee-deep in fish heads, covered in slime, and ripping the guts out of fish. That was a really weird experience. But I loved it. And when I quit this job 3 weeks later, hating it, I realized that for the first time in my life, I was actually happy because of the choices I made all along the way, choosing what felt better each way. That was a long time. I was born in 1956, and this didn't happen until 30 years later. But you gotta start somewhere. So, anyways, I'm traveling down the west coast from Alaska. That's way up north, going down the west coast of North America. I eventually run into Silicon Valley, where I could sling bits rather than slime for a living, and where I could make enough money in 3 months to pay for life for the rest of the year, which is pretty cool. And I did that for a number of years. But after more than a decade of this, I wanted more than just a pretty cool life. I wanted a life that I loved living. Somehow that had to be possible. So I quit doing work that I didn't love, and I had this experiment on myself. What would life be like if I had a year of money saved up, which I did, and I would only choose to do what I loved doing, and laundry? So I didn't know. And I didn't know how I would make money, because jobs aren't that come along aren't always ones that I love. So how would I make money? Well, I started doing stuff that I knew I loved, like volunteer work, and there was plenty of that in San Francisco where I was living. And I was doing all sorts of other things. But when I was working in electronics, when I came home, I didn't want to play with electronics. And I had all these ideas for projects of my own that had just been just waiting and waiting in the background. But now I had time. I wasn't working in electronics, so I didn't have to come home. I was home. I can do whatever I wanted. I could even play with electronics. And I did. A lot of people ask me where ideas come from. And any inventor or artist or musician or whatever, this is a question people often ask. Nobody knows where ideas come from. But they come from within, from without, whatever, and it comes from things that we like about ourselves, things we hate about ourselves, things that we think are wrong with ourselves, all the shit in our lives, whatever. It all comes together in our experience and it comes out as an idea. Like I said, I quit TV in 1980. I got rid of the 50 TVs from my apartment. I used to collect them. People throw them away when they don't work and I fix them, whatever. I got rid of all of them. And that horrible force in my life was gone and I had plenty of time to explore and do things which were way more worthwhile. But then in 1993, TVs started appearing in public places. Can you imagine that the world before that date did not have TVs in public places? Compare that with now, especially in the country that I left. They are everywhere. They started popping up in 93, and this invasive force that I got rid of from my apartment started attacking me everywhere I looked. You can't even place your eyeballs anywhere without being marketed at. And having these horrible messages repeating over and over again that aren't there for you, they're not there for me, they're there for power and profit, and not our power and profit. Anyways, I couldn't do anything about those TVs, but I am a geek, so I knew that I could make a remote control to turn them all off. So I did. So inventing is three very simple steps that is not simple to follow, but first, seeing a problem like TVs all over in public. Second is the idea to solve the problem, and that's the one button remote control to turn them all off. And then finally, implementation. And that can take a while, but even getting to that takes a while. This took 10 years before I was in a place to actually do something about my ideas. So anyways, in 2003, after spending a year and a half working on this, obsessed, I had TV Be Gone in my hand and I could give them away to friends who wanted them. That was a 30-second TV commercial for TV Be Gone that some friends of mine made. Of course, they never thought it would be played on TV, but it was. Projects always take way longer than you think, and it took me a year and a half to get TV Be Gone together, and with the experience I had working for all those other companies, I knew how to manufacture, and since friends of mine all wanted TV Be Gone, and then friends of theirs, and friends of friends, it was like, I'll just manufacture some and see if I can sell some. And I was just doing it because I love doing this, and all these friends of mine were helping me because it was taking longer than I thought and they wanted them, so we were all doing it just because we loved working on this. We certainly weren't thinking about making money from it, but I sort of fantasized, well, you know, if I could sell these, maybe it could supplement my income, but whatever. The results were, the first day of sales, I got $24,000 from a Wired.com article that came out at 2 a.m. The website was ready at 5:05 a.m. on October 19th, 2004. And I know that time because as soon as we made the website live, we started getting messages that there were orders. Ding, ding, ding. Ding, 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 ding. And we thought there was a bug, but there wasn't. There were people hitting the F5 key waiting for the site to go live. It says coming soon from 2 to 5:05 in the morning. Like, what the hell? But anyways, then National Public Radio in the United States called me, and the BBC and New York Times and People magazine. That's I don't know if there's an equivalent here. This is like the biggest trash ever, but millions of people read it. And I was on it, and I was even live on Fox TV News, turning off all of their monitors. And actually, that was funny because there were all these people at Fox News. Three different people independently came up to me, and they're like, agree with you. But they were afraid that other people would. Anyways, 19 years later, and 880,000 of these things sold. It's still supporting me and 12 friends making a living on this weird little thing that we just did because we loved. And it's still a small sustainable business, Cornfield Electronics. It's not the next big thing. It's not billions of people buying it. It doesn't have to be. It's a small sustainable business that me and some friends continue to make a living on, getting enough of what we need to keep doing what we love doing. So I have a question for all of you. What is success? Kind of a big question. Most people, at least in the country that I left, haven't really thought about it, and when that question comes along, they just think of this. Is that success? No!
Of course not!
It's a pile of money. That is not success. What did you do if you have that pile of money? What did you do to get it? How many people did you hurt? How much of yourself have you hurt? How much time went away? How much energy went away? What happened to the world in the process? What happened to your life in the process? There's nothing wrong with a pile of money just in and of itself, but what you do to get it might be. But that's up to each of you to decide, only. Of course, you can ask friends for opinions as well. But that pile of money is not success. You might be able to do some cool things with a pile of money if you have it, but again, what are you willing to do to get those in order to do that cool stuff? And how cool is that stuff compared to what you had to do? Well, here's my definition of success, and I pretty much already said it. If you're doing what you love doing, and by doing it, you get enough of whatever you need, including money, to keep doing it, what more do you need? If after that you keep going out and making more money, that's a waste of time and life and energy. So I'll just stay here. I have opinions. So you don't have to agree with me, but I hope, you know, and I've thought about what I'm saying a lot through my life. It doesn't mean I'm right. It's just my opinion and the way I live my life. But I think there are concepts in there worth thinking about. So TV Be Gone, one of the reasons it was successful and continues to be is that it's open source, open hardware. In 2003, when I started doing TV Be Gone, there was really no such thing as open hardware. There were some projects which pretty much were, like TV Be Gone, open, but all the design files and everything are online. And because of that, all these people made TV Be Gone, and I didn't get a cent from that, but they would tell everyone about it, and that's PR that I could not afford as a small company. And it also created a lot of goodwill, and a lot of people helped me make it much better as a result. A lot of people informed me when there were people not playing too well with the ecosystem, and I actually had to sue a former customer to make him stop putting out a copy. All he had to do was use my open source plans, but instead he made a bad copy, and I had to sue him to make him stop because he used my name, and I got all the angry emails. Anyways, open hardware is great, open source is great, and even if I never make any money from all the other people copying it, those people are making a device to help other people to turn TVs off, which is why I was doing TV Be Gone to begin with. And if they're helping, great! The more, the better. And I want to talk a little bit about startups, since it's so much a part of our world now. You've probably noticed that there's a few startups around. I live in Berlin, where they're really pushing hard. I came from Silicon Valley, where they're even pushing harder. Everywhere in the world, they're trying to copy Silicon Valley. And Silicon Valley is horrible. Why would anyone want to copy that? It's making the world a horrible place. So anyways, there are probably startups here in Dresden too, and you've probably noticed. And you've probably noticed that almost all of the startups are stupid. Have you noticed that? They're stupid because people call themselves entrepreneurs and they think of this as the primary goal. That guarantees that you will have a stupid startup if you start with that. Let me just mention here about this capitalism. You probably also notice that we kind of live with capitalism. Capitalism, though, if you think about it at all, is really absurd. There are all these like pieces of paper with numbers in the corner, or though now it's really banking computers sending a number on people's screens, big and small, but it's really absurd, because if the numbers in the corner of the pieces of paper or the number on the screen isn't big enough, you don't get to eat. You don't get to have a place to live. You don't get to have a few things that you might want in your life. In order to get the number big enough on the screen, or the numbers in the corner of the pieces of paper big enough, people get these things called jobs. Even if they don't like the jobs, they have this job so they can make enough money so that they can buy food and buy shelter and buy a few things. Hello. Hi. So here they are, spending 8 hours a day, and then sleeping 8 hours a day, where they're probably dreaming about this, and then spending the rest of their life staring at screens, just to get enough money so that hopefully they have food and shelter and a few things they might like. That's one way to do it. It's not necessarily a fun way to live, but it's an option. There are other options, however. You know, you can create your own work or join someone else who's created their own work. And I like encouraging people to consider that option. There are other options as well, but the one I'm going to talk about is this one. So entrepreneurship, in a real sense, is not this. If you start off, like I said, thinking about this as the starting point and the end goal, then you are almost guaranteed to fail. And fail traumatically, and no fun at all. You'll learn a lot, because we learn a lot from our failures, but it won't be fun. If you're gonna do it with any probability of success at all, you have to come about it like this. Entrepreneurship is about finding meaning, if you're gonna do it for real. And you don't have to do entrepreneurship, like I said. It's just something to consider, or joining someone who's doing it. But if you're going to do it, you have to do it this way. You make time and you explore. You can do this on your own, but you can do it much better in a supportive community like a hackerspace, which I'll mention in a little bit. So you explore, you try things, you see what works, what doesn't work. You fail. And you fail a lot. We fail much more than we succeed, and we need to learn from our failures as much as our successes. because we do fail a lot more than we succeed. And we can learn from all of that. Some of it's fun, some of it isn't. But you repeat. There are ups, there are downs. You make more time, you keep exploring, you keep trying. What works, what doesn't work. You fail, you succeed, you fail, you fail, you fail. You keep learning, you keep trying. Eventually, you find something that's meaningful for you. And you see that maybe it's meaningful for others. If it is meaningful for others, that is exactly what they will pay you to provide for them. And now you have a startup worth starting. Providing something that's meaningful for you to other people who also find it meaningful. It doesn't have to be the next Apple or Google. There's already one too many Apple and one too many Google. We don't need any more. Growth is not always good. There's nothing wrong with growth, but you don't have to grow. If you're doing something meaningful and you're providing it to other people who find it meaningful and there are more people who want it and you need to grow in order to provide it to them, fine, grow, it's okay. But you don't need to grow. All you need is to get enough of what you need in order to keep doing what you're doing so that you can keep living a life that you find wonderful, awesome. Fabulous, amazing, awesome, all those things. You can do that. What would your life be like if you had a project that you could provide other people and they'll pay you or give you enough resources of whatever you need in order for you to keep doing that? What would your life be like? And what if some percentage of all of Dresden had those kind of opportunities? What if all of Germany, Europe, the planet? What if there are hundreds of millions of these kind of small sustainable companies? I mean, we have capitalism, it's not going away, so this is just one way to go about things. The world would be a much different place. I have a free service that I provide to all of you and everyone. If you ever find yourself in a position where you don't like your job, contact me. I am really good into talking people into quitting jobs they do not like. So I love sharing my skills, my experiences with people of any age, any skill level. And in 2006, when I came across this concept of maker fairs, I was just blown away. It was so wonderful. Here's a few hundred people showing off these projects that they love. And they're all really interesting projects. And then there were thousands and thousands of people just watching and being inspired by it. But no one was making anything, which I thought was weird for something called Maker Faire. So the next Maker Faire, I set up a table of soldering irons and taught people how to solder. And it was super popular. And I did it the next year, and it grew to be over 3,000 people in a weekend teaching how to make a little blinky badge. And it was fun. I did that for a number of years. I started writing for Make Magazine, which was the same company that put on the Maker Faires. The first project that I wrote about was Brain Machine, which is this weird thing that, well, here's a video.
Let me show you what this looks like when you put them on. There's the glasses, and here's the headphones. And then let's turn it on. So there you go. That's what you'll hear and see when you put these on. I'm Bree Pettis here with Mitch Altman, and this project is in Make Magazine Volume 10. Go ahead and get it, get the parts, make it on up, and have a great weekend.
So that goes at brainwave frequencies, and it helps people meditate. But what made it really popular is that people hallucinate while they're wearing them. People seem to like hallucinating. So that guy, Bree Pettis, was one of the three people who created MakerBot out of NYC Resistor Hackerspace in New York City. And It was wildly successful. It wasn't all good. He managed to lose all of his friends in the process of turning it from an open source international project into one where he could make $604 million selling it. Yeah. So, yeah, a lot of people, anyways, more long stories. Anyways, that same year, 2006, just a couple months later, I went to my first hacker conference, which I was invited to Maker Faire because of TV Be Gone, and I was invited to my first hacker conference, HOPE, Hackers on Planet Earth, also because of TV Be Gone, and I love this so much that I've been helping organize it ever since. It's every 2 years in New York, the one coming up in July. I'll actually fly to the old country for this. So Hackers on Planet Earth is pretty wonderful. And my second hacker conference was in Berlin at the time, put on by the Chaos Computer Club, CCC, C3. This was the 23rd one in 2006. And that was even better. And my third hacker conference, oh, and also, no one was making things here either. So my next one, 24C3, I set up a table of soldering irons, and that just grew and grew. And it's fun. Now there's two huge halls full of people making stuff, which is great. Anyways, in my third hacker conference was a camp. It happens every 4 years. It's outside of Berlin. And crazy, wonderful. Every tent had AC power and gigabit Ethernet. That's kind of crazy. And of course, I set up soldering irons. And there was a talk there about how to start your own hackerspace, which inspired me and other people to start the early hackerspaces in the US. Because if we could have that all day, all night, every day, all year round, rather than wait for the next conference or Maker Faire or whatever, that's way cool. And it was. And a lot of people were watching, and along with the other hackerspaces that existed, it became a movement, and now there are zillions all over the world. But NoiseBridge started with 54 people, and I started doing this weekly soldering thing called Circuit Hacking Monday. It started small, it grew rather quickly, and I'm still doing this stuff. When there's not a pandemic, when it is online, I just love sharing this, and people like it, so I'll keep doing it. Yeah, that was right before the pandemic. Leipzig, yeah.
Never.
Yep. So I've been doing workshops all over the world and talks. So anyways, hacking, all of you probably know this already. There's lots of definitions. There's the one most people know, which is breaking into computers and stealing shit. That's a newer definition. The version we're using is an older definition, not like taking an axe and breaking things into bits. That's even an older definition. But the definition from Hackerspaces is, as I see it, seeing the world full of resources. And the world is full of resources. And we can use those resources any way we want, including improving our projects. And we don't have to use those resources the way they were put there, the intention of putting them there by whoever put them there. We can use them for our own imaginations any way we like to improve our projects. We can see what works, what doesn't, and we share with other people. This is what hacking is all about. And most of all, it's amazingly enjoyable. So we keep doing that. It's definitely a mindset and a way of being for all ages. And if we put that together with community, supportive community in a physical space, now we have a hackerspace. And of course, when people think of hacking, they usually think of tech. And of course, we can hack on tech, but we can hack on anything. Art and craft. To be a good artist, you have to be a good hacker mindset person. And craft, science, scientists are all great hackers. We can hack ourselves. We are one lifelong project that constantly can be improved, and hacking on that is the way to do that. Hacking on our communities to make them better over time. The planet sorely needs improvement, and if we don't hack on it, who will? Everything can and should be hacked. And if we do that in community, it's even more powerful. And when we get together in community, we probably want to make things, and to make things, we probably want tools. And there's all sorts of tools, old ones and new ones, all sorts of tools for making tech, of course, but fabricating mechanical things like the workshops here, and art and craft and music, music good and bad, and food and science, everything. And we do it because when we get together in a supportive community to explore and find things we enjoy, it's enjoyable. These people are just learning to solder. That's at 30C3 in Hamburg. And they're just learning to solder, but look how happy everyone is. It's so fun. Education is definitely something that needs to be hacked, and I've been working on that for the last 10 years or so. Kind of accidentally found myself getting into this, but schools, you know, it's usually not quite this bad, but it's more like this than not. Everyone's in rows and columns with an authority at the front spouting information that you have to absorb and give back on a test. The test is supposed to be about evaluating learning, but instead, schools are all about these standardized tests, which are supposed to be about the learning, but instead it's training people to do well on these tests. That's fucked. It's no fun to go to these training institutes from the age of 6 through 18, day after day, 8 hours a day, doing nothing but being trained to take a test. Learning is fun. Actual learning is fun. It's play-based. We learn by playing all through our lives. We play differently as little kids, infants on up, and as adults, but we play and we learn by playing. And hackerspaces are places where we do this. Hackerspaces are fantastic educational environments. So I started giving talks about this. Oddly enough, the place I started giving talks about this was China, and there's a lot of weird circumstances about that, but it leads from one thing to another, and then suddenly I'm talking to a room full of Ministry of Education bureaucrats. And they're into it. So, and there was a period of time in China where this is being encouraged. Those days are over, but it was exciting being there. And so anyways, I was given free rein to do all sorts of crazy stuff, and people are engaged. It's totally wonderful. And it grew even bigger to be these huge conferences. This is just one of several where I'm giving a talk to all of these more Ministry of Education people. But education should look like this, at least for electronics, but it can look similarly for any subject. So hackerspaces are totally cool. They're places where we can do all that kind of stuff. Teaching, learning, sharing, supportive environments for exploring what each of us really enjoys doing. So here's just a few pictures of the hackerspaces I was visiting in the year before the pandemic. And these are only some of them. And, you know, there's a bunch in China since I was in China. And, Japan, there's a bunch in Belgium, big ones, little ones, Fab Lab, Makerspace, Hackerspace, same difference. But it's these supportive environments where everybody's engaged and everyone's doing cool things. There's Urbana, Illinois, where the University of Illinois is, where I went to university. And the Fab Lab there, which is a great community there. Fab Labs often are not, but this one is. And this is where I just was 2 weeks ago in Enschede, Netherlands, giving a workshop on LED strips, which was fun. It's just great to be with geeks again doing live things. So one way to get people to explore hackerspaces. I made hackerspace passports, and a lot of hackerspaces have stamps. Is there a stamp here?
We don't have stamps.
There's a bleep stamp for the circuit control, so the festival.
Okay.
It's not actually about from space, but we can count it as like this.
Okay. Well, I got my passport with me, so. Wow.
There's a laser cutter over there.
We will figure something out this
okay.
week.
Oh, yes. Great. I'm here this week. So, another way of sharing and learning is through residencies. So, artists in residencies have existed for a long, long, long time, like over 100 years. You go to a place, you share your art, you learn from the community there, and then you go off to your next place and share what you learn, cross-pollinating everywhere. The first time I was invited was in this place in Providence, Rhode Island, AS220, where it led to a really popular kit that I have. So I taught, you know, like 10,000 people how to solder that way. I've taught over 80,000 people how to solder, by the way. So I guess I like it. I was invited back again in 2015 and did a bunch of stuff then. At the University of Illinois, I was invited in several times to give a month of workshops. It's called Unit 1. And a lot of people seem to like brain machines. So there's 2014. I got the front page of the local newspaper. You know, that was a highlight. So yeah, 2016, and then again 2018. Hopefully again soon. The most recent one was last summer. I was invited to a residency at the Museumsquartier in Vienna, Austria. And I made this thing that was a fun way to talk about surveillance and technology and the promises of technology. This webcam looks at you and then it promises to calculate all of your innermost desires and then play the perfect lounge music song to fulfill those desires. And of course, it falls way short of that promise, like all technology. So this got into Ars Electronica, which is kind of a big deal, and that was fun. So, but as well as artists in residence, why not hacker in residence? It doesn't have to be merely about visual or performing arts. So this is the Hacker in Residence in Santiago, Chile, and I did another Hacker in Residence in Tel Aviv, Israel, and Zagreb, Croatia, and then at Tsinghua University in China, which is the best university in China. This is the university where all of the leaders of China have been groomed for the last 150 years. It's kind of a scary place, but during this period where things were opening up, it was very exciting and we could do very weird stuff that was approved by the president of the university. And so anyways, the next year there was the first International Maker Day at Tsinghua, and then the next year, things happened fast in China, the world's largest hackerspace was built. That's what they called it, the quotes, see, quotes, quotes. So 65,000 square meters, because it goes many floors down below as well. Crazy time. So workshop tours, ended up doing some workshops in some pretty crazy places, like the Catacombs in Paris. Workshop tours, talk tours, whatever. Another way to share that it's fun is helping other people come together at conferences. Like I've been doing this since 24C3 and the Hardware Hacking Area. This is just the one at 30C3 in Hamburg, at various camps, Fried Camp in Belgium, and EMF Camp in the UK, and CCC Camp, of course. That was the most recent one. Yeah, everyone's just always engaged. They're fun. And then organizing other conferences. This is a conference about super intense open hardware projects that we had two of these. Yeah, there was this one kid at one of them who made a fusion reactor in his mom's basement. He was 17. What could possibly go wrong? And then these people in former Soviet Union who got old radio telescopes and made them work and then published everything online. It's all open source. There was another one that wasn't recorded and online. All these, the other ones are still online for free, of course. But one that wasn't online was finding in a recycle place in San Francisco where a bunch of these hundreds of thousands of dollar instruments for sequencing DNA were thrown away. And so he reverse engineered them and made them work again. but he didn't want to get in trouble from that company because they've got a lot of money. Anyways, like I said, I'm still organizing Hope Hackers on Planet Earth. I organize these huge areas where thousands of people learn to solder every week, weekend at a Maker Faire, and I poured my heart and soul into Maker Faire. And in 2011, I was honored by having an award in my name. It was the Mitch Altman Maker Hero Award, and I got the first one. And, and if you want to see a video of me crying, you can look online for that. But unfortunately, that was the first Mitch Altman Maker Hero Award and the last. Because right after getting that award, there was a thank you dinner for all the people who helped, and it was announced that Maker Faire accepted $10 million from the US military. And I could not, in good conscience, keep doing that. And there was no strings attached, that's what they kept saying, but of course they just happened to have the military recruiting at 1,000 high schools that Maker Faire had exhibits at. And they just happened to have the keynote talk from General Alexander, who heads Defense Advanced Research Projects Administration. No strings attached, though. So anyways, yeah. And then another way for sharing, learning from people in China and taking outsiders to share what we do, and just learning cross-culturally. I did a hacker trip to China for all of these years. This is definitely my last one, though. But yeah, that's at the Beijing airport. Oops. That was a fun way to get to come into China all jet lagged. But yeah, we would share with people and we'd learn from the people there, just like residencies, except we were traveling around. We got invited to huge corporations, you know, international hackers, to Threenod. No one knows Threenod, but that's a company that makes pretty much everything. Like Logitech puts their name on Threenod things, and lots of other companies, JBL and stuff. So, and then we get invited into CEO's rooms because he wants to learn from us, and you know, and then of course there's more bureaucrats to talk to, and then they give us lots of food. The food is great.
Oh, the food. But the food.
And of course I met mayors of all these towns, so no one ever heard of Zhangzhou. But, oh, I forgot the G there. It should be Zhangzhou. But this is a rubbing off of an ancient thing when Zhangzhou was the capital of part of China during, I think, the Warring States. Anyways, and I meet the live on CCTV with the mayor of Xi'an. So, and all this leads to the second in command of the entire country of China visiting a hackerspace in Shenzhen and making a big deal out of it live on CCTV. And then after that, every bureaucrat, in order to be a cool little bureaucrat, must have a hackerspace. Otherwise, you're not a cool, you know, good little bureaucrat. They don't understand anything, but they built the world's largest hackerspace. But then that happened. So that's over. But it was worth trying. You know, like, things don't always turn out as you expect. But I never expected starting a hackerspace to turn into a movement with the help of zillions of other people, of course. But, you know, we all play our part. I didn't expect to have the world's largest hackerspace just be a building. And I certainly didn't expect China to become fascist regime. So, yeah. what we do goes out into the world in the context of the world. And the cultural context is way more powerful than any one of us. So we have to just keep that in mind as we do things. Throughout my entire life playing with electronics, I've had to contend with this, coming from the country that I came from, where the biggest single part of the economy is the U.S. military. The U.S. military is actually 6 times the budget of the rest of the entire world put together. And it's called defense. So anyways, there are a lot of people paid really, really well to look at everything that we do, everything, and turning it into killing, destroying, and spying. And also marketing. Marketing's important. Have you been marketed that yet today? It's important. So here's just a very few little bits of my CV. My first job with computers was a summer job in 1978 making computer games. It was really cool. It was on an Apple II computer. It was really janky with these little line drawings and kind of cheap, cheap, cheap. You didn't shoot anything or anything. You just kind of navigated in 3D space through galaxies and stuff. So the military comes along and says, "Ha! Nice game you got there. If you could just sort of modify it a bit, customize it, we could use it for killer helicopter training simulators." And the bosses said, "Hell yeah, that'd be a lot of money. Great." And then I, of course, quit. That was my first job. The second job was interactive museum exhibits. And this was in 1980. There were no graphics cards then, so we had to make our own. So I made this box. It was about this big. It's like bigger than a server. And it was not as good as a 30-euro graphics card. But it was really cool for 1980, and the U.S. military came along and said, "Phew, we can use that to market weapon systems to Congress." And the bosses said, "Great, we'll make a lot of money." And then I quit. In 1987, when I was creating virtual reality with a handful of people at this company in Silly Valley, none of us, including the president, the bosses, everything, all the way down, no military. We all agreed, but the military got it anyways through the University of Central Florida, who bought it. And of course, the universities in the United States are all funded by the military. We wouldn't sell it to them, so they got it through the University of Central Florida, and they use it for a World War III training simulator. And I helped. That was on a system that I spent 3 months of my life doing. So, VR has never seemed so exciting to me since then. At Threeware, the company I started, that we made RAID controllers, these storage controller things that plug into a PC, and then the PC operating system sees like super high performance storage. So I quit because the investors took over and made it the worst job ever. But shortly after I quit, they hired a guy to sell to the NSA, the Secret Service of the United States, for storage. This is 97, so people really didn't think about the NSA then, but of course I did. And I wasn't too happy about that, but I couldn't do anything because, you know, my 5% of the company was nothing compared to the VCs. So, vulture capitalists, venture capitalists. So, they wanted to sell it to the NSA. But fortunately, the guy was inept and they didn't buy it, but they bought it from someone else, and we know what they're using that for. And then in 2004, I did TV Be Gone. And it turns out there's no military application. So yeah, cultural context is kind of important. But you know, as long as the cultural context remains this negativity with capitalism and power and profit being the incentive for all of these corporations and so many people, this is going to be a problem. So it's important for us to create better cultural context. And that's exactly what we're doing here. Hackerspaces are fantastic positive cultural contexts. And if we continue to make more communities, not just hackerspaces, but other supportive communities where people are encouraged to explore and find things that are enjoyable, that are meaningful, that are worthwhile, and each community helps the others wherever it makes sense and helps others start, help each other overcome problems, maybe we can create some better context within which we can release our creative output for more positive results. So, the future. As a species, we are incredibly horrible at figuring that out. But we're creating it right now by the choices we make. And if we do that with a hacker mindset, then perhaps we can apply that to our choices. We can make a choice. We have no control over what the consequences are, but we can learn from them. Good, bad, what worked, what didn't. Share it with others, be supported in others. We can do that on our own. We can do it better in a supportive community. Make more choices, hopefully a little better, maybe. Learn from the consequences. And now we can make hopefully a little better choices. Sometimes worse, sometimes better, not always as expected. Sometimes better, sometimes worse. Learning from all these consequences. Little bit at a time, hopefully with the ups and downs, things improve. Maybe. Worth trying. Maybe our lives become better. Maybe they become full of puppies. But we can share our skills and our experiences along the way. And we can find meaningful, fun projects. We can try new things and hopefully solve the rather serious problems facing us as a species and other species. It's up to us to do this, because if we wait for our leaders to do it, we know what's going to happen. So let's get together and do cool shit. We can create more opportunities, not only for ourselves, but many other people around us. So, and maybe the world comes a little bit better as a result. There again is my contact info.
Hack the planet.
Hack the planet.